Good morning. Jalal ud-Din Rumi, who was born in the year 1207 in today's Tajikistan, that's its name today, died in 1273 in Konya, in what's called Turkey today, has been the most popular poet in the United States since at least 2007. So his poem that we sing as a hymn, Come, Come, Whoever You Are, was set to music by Lynn Unger, who is a member of a liberal religious youth group that I led in a land that was called California in the 1970s. Rumi's own group of both older and younger followers persists to this day in the form of the Mevlevi Sufi order, better known to many of us as the Whirling Dervishes. He also wrote many prose essays, which are less familiar to us than his dance and poetry. And here's a passage from one of those. In God's world, there is nothing more difficult than enduring the ridiculous. Now, I didn't read that story to the kids. That had nothing to do with the election. Nothing at all. Suppose, for instance, that you've read a certain book, corrected, amended, and fully vocalized it. Then someone sitting next to you, beside you, reads that book all wrongly. Can you endure that? No, it's impossible. If, however, you've not read the book, it makes no difference to you whether the other person reads it wrongly or reads it right. You cannot distinguish wrong from right. So enduring the ridiculous is a great discipline. But does this mean we should give up on making some improvement over time? Must we remain stuck where we are, like the north-going Zacks and the south-going Zacks, making the world go around us? Well, here's Rumi again. So, a teacher is teaching a child how to write. When he comes to writing a whole line, the child writes a line and shows it to the teacher. In the teacher's eyes, it is all wrong and bad. But the teacher speaks to the child kindly and cajolingly. This is all very good. You've written well. Bravo, bravo. Only this letter you've written badly. This is how it ought to be. So the teacher demonstrates. Oh, yes, that letter too. That's also written badly. The teacher calls bad a few letters out of that line and shows the child how they ought to be written. The rest he praises so that the child may not lose heart. The child's weakness gathers strength from that approval. And so, gradually, he's taught and assisted on the way. Rumi speaks here of those who are honestly seeking instruction and ways to improve. They have a lot to learn, but at least they're committed to learning. Earlier, he spoke of those who seem to have made more commitment to misunderstanding and ignorance than to learning. Someone who reads things wrongly, people who read things wrongly, and do it with great relish. How do we navigate? How do we get around or move with each other in a world that we have to share with both? Is it enough to just come, come, whoever you are, and seek no further guidance? Let's think some more about that after we sing another song. How about For the Beauty of the Earth, one of the autumn classics? Thank you, Justin. You play that with such peace. I never noticed how much peace is in that hymn. It's just really lovely. Really sweet. I'm sure it's not the way we remember it from school. Well, a book fills the news. The whole world focuses on a single text, which few have read at all, let alone read correctly. People demanding that it be banned worldwide or killed in a riot. There are more riots in more countries and more deaths almost every day. Then the head of a religious state issues a death warrant against the author of the book. Millions of dollars and a place in heaven are promised to whoever will kill him. Some bookstores remove the book from their shelves. Two bookstores are bombed. Soon, authors and free speech advocates also take to the streets, first with hesitation and then with a sense of mission, all for a book and what it means to write one and publish it to the world. What kind of book is this? It's a book of imagination, building on, drawing from, and playing with history in its fiction. It's a book like most books by an author. The author's name is Salman Rushdie, and the book is called The Satanic Verses. I probably didn't need to tell you that. The year is 1989. 1,400 years earlier, another book had filled the news. There were fewer kinds of media then: gossip, sarcastic poetry, shouts, whispers. But this book dominated them all. It too is a matter of controversy, of scandal. The book and its readers were detested by those who rejected its message. Death threats were also commonly made against the man most closely associated with it, and his supporters lived for years under economic and social sanctions, as well as the constant threat of armed attack. What kind of book was this one? It was a different kind of book. You might say that it came out as a serial in installments that were eagerly awaited by a few devoted readers. It circulated orally and in bits and pieces, written on paper, and skin, chunks of shoulder bone. Some people committed the bits to memory. And now that it's complete, many still memorize the whole thing. But this book is believed to have no human author. It did not arrive by an act of imagination or invention or even of insight. The book was made known by a reciter, by a messenger, relaying a message. That messenger's name was Muhammad. And the book is called the Quran. I probably also didn't need to tell you that. The Quran, though, is not Muhammad's book, and it barely mentions him at all. Islam teaches that the Quran is uncreated and eternal. It's the very word of God, not words inspired by God, but God's own exact words. To hear it is to hear God speaking. We could say that Islam means to be at peace with God, to find peace in the world through reading this book of his words correctly. I probably also don't need to tell you that the course of history began to change with this book's first word. Soon the avid readers of this book were almost in China, India, Spain, Sicily. But the first word was heard in a cave in the year 610. The word Iqra. It's a command by the book itself to read or recite each and every word of it as soon as it comes. When the last words of this book were received on a day in March in 632, the legs of the reciter's camels are said to have buckled under the weight of the last words God will ever speak to us in clear language until the last day that humans live on earth. It's pure holy speech. It arrives in our world in a human language, Arabic, but it's not human speech at all. God is the speaker, every sentence, every word. The prophet shares this holy speech with the people. He shares his own words too at times, of course. He's also a husband, a father, a small businessman, a community member. But these words, the words of the Quran, are not his own words. Nabi means prophet. Muhammad was a prophet, but he was also Rasul, a messenger of God. He was a transmitter of messages. So here's an English translation of some verses from a chapter called The Star, describing this process of transmission with both human and non-human actors. By the star, when it plunges, your comrade is not astray, neither errs, nor does he speak out of caprice. This is nothing but a revelation revealed, taught him by one terrible in power, very strong. He stood poised, being on the higher horizon, and drew near and hung suspended, sort of floating in the air, I guess, two bow's lengths away or nearer, then revealed to his servant what he revealed. What's alluded to in this passage goes for all the messages of the book. God spoke those messages to the archangel Jibril, Arabic for Gabriel. That's the he who stood poised, who next spoke them to Muhammad, who then spoke them to the world. Those messages are the Quran. The holy speech we hear comes at the end of a chain of straightforward transmissions. God, angel, prophet, people. But there's more angels than Gabriel. There's a fallen angel in Islam, just as there is in Christian tradition. His name is given sometimes as Shaitan. Does that sound familiar? Shaitan. Good ears. Sometimes it's Iblis. Once God's favorite, or at least that's how he saw himself, he was cast from God's presence for defying God's word. God ordered all the angels to bow before his final creation, human beings, us. Satan was the only one who refused, on the grounds that angels were created from eternal light, but these things were made from clay or mud. God said, bow to it. Satan said, you talking to me? It's kind of Robert De Niro. You talking to me? Did you tell me to bow to that? To one of those? Ew! Ew! You're kidding! So now, although his light has been lessened, this angel devil is still very bright, resourceful, and also very jealous. Now, how can he hurt these upstart mud creatures who he blames for his downfall? Where can he strike most effectively? Well, his trouble started with some words of God that he feels were wrongly spoken. Where better to strike but at the transmission point of those words? At the transmission itself. Just as the devil's encounter with Jesus in the gospel temptation stories was inevitable, so is the encounter of Satan with the Quran. It's unthinkable that such an assault would not occur. Obviously, he couldn't get to God or Gabriel. There's no point going after the prophet's followers since there was so much hostility towards them already, and their own relatives were among the most hostile. One of the prophet's cranky old aunties had even pelted him recently with a rotting sheep's uterus. Talk about ew! Did you get that sense? I could see Laurel's shoulders going. Ew! Now, the weak link in this chain was Muhammad himself, a big-hearted human being who wanted to help his neighbors. The devil's efforts to impose his words into the Quran is called the incident of the satanic verses. As a former angel himself, the devil could imitate words like those delivered by Gabriel, and he could speak with the same angel accent. So he slipped some of his own verses to the prophet. They not only fooled him, but they were also real crowd pleasers that seemed to let people hang on to some of the old Arabian gods as helpers to that one who was sending them the Quran. This is the story of the satanic verses, as reported by generations of early authors whose Islamic credentials are considered impeccable. Their accounts tell us that Muhammad didn't catch his own mistake, but that the angel Gabriel caught it for him. It's a perfectly orthodox position. To suggest that Muhammad spotted the errors himself would invite speculation that he checked his revelations for consistency, edited them, perhaps even altered or even authored some of them himself. That would be blasphemy. Holy speech is God's speech, remember, not the prophet's. It's important to understand that tradition counts this whole incident to Muhammad's credit. It tells us that God acted quickly to comfort his badly shaken messenger. He sent down new Quran verses, making light of the affair and assuring Muhammad that he was in the company of such other struggling messengers as Moses and Jesus. "We've not sent a messenger or prophet before you, but when he longed, Satan cast suggestions into his longing. But God will annul what Satan has suggested. Then God will establish his verses, God being knowing and wise." So Muhammad could rest assured that such things happened to all true prophets. God himself would take care of proofreading and correcting the text. Diane, you make your job easier, wouldn't it? As an editor. So Salman Rushdie did not invent the story of the satanic verses. Instead, he makes use of this older literary event in a novel. A novel that's filled with complex imagery and written at a very, very high level of English prose. It begins with two men falling through the sky from a jetliner which has just exploded, falling and having conversations and arguments. One of these characters will gradually become insane as the story unfolds. He'll murder the woman he loves, and eventually he'll take his own life. The scenes in the novel, which draw from the traditional story of the satanic verses, in fact, all of the passages in the book that were deemed offensive, take place in this character's dreams or hallucinations. So the reader has to stay wide awake to take this whole thing in. Dreams within stories, stories within stories. Not an easy read. It's a difficult book to read. But if you conclude that such a tortured character's delusions are the book's real message, then, to use Rumi's words, you've read it all wrongly. If you insist on your conclusion in spite of every attempt to correct it and explain the author's intent and do so without having read it at all, then you're being ridiculous. Unfortunately, as we saw with the Zacks, being ridiculous never seems to stop anyone from also being violent. In 1990, Salman Rushdie looked back on a year of reaction to the book, including that death sentence pronounced on him by the Ayatollah Khomeini. "I set out to explore," he writes, "through the process of fiction, the nature of revelation and the power of faith. The mystical, revelatory experience like that of the prophet is quite clearly a genuine one. This statement poses a problem to the non-believer. If we accept that the mystic, the prophet, is sincerely undergoing some kind of transcendent experience, yet we cannot believe in a supernatural world, then what is going on? I genuinely believe that my overt use of fabulation would make it clear to any reader that I was not attempting to falsify history, but to allow fiction to take off from history. The use of dreams was intended to say, the point is not whether this really happened. The point is to examine what such an incident might reveal about what revelation is. About the extent to which the mystic's conscious personality informs and interacts with the mystical event. The point is to try to understand the human event of revelation. The use of fiction was a way of creating the sort of distance from actuality that I felt would prevent offense from being taken. I was wrong. Boy, was he ever. Do you remember? Do you remember those weeks in the news? Rushdie was trying to present something of real value to everyone who would take the time to actually read it and read it carefully. After 4 years of writing, his book had been carefully vetted by editors, reviewers, and publishers, none of whom could anticipate the violent reaction that was coming. Nothing like it had ever happened before. Boy, were they surprised. But boy, have things changed since then. 1989, that's a long time ago in many ways. Do you remember the news this September and the anti-Islam video that provoked outrage that may have also led to the death of several Libyans and Americans, including U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens? It's become an issue during our presidential campaign. The actors who appear in the video claim they'd responded to a casting call for an action film called Desert Warrior and had no idea that it would be used to portray the Prophet Muhammad, quote, as a womanizer, buffoon, ruthless killer, and child molester. They said that throughout filming, this negative character was called George. But his name was changed during post-production, and a number of lines that they had never spoken were dubbed in. One is now suing the video maker, someone who clearly anticipated that his film would insult and enrage people, and that most people wouldn't want to be involved with it if they knew his real intent. Boy, was he right. His identity was unclear at first, in part because he's used a number of aliases. It turns out that he had served prison time for fraud, and as a condition for probation, was forbidden from accessing computers or the internet. His video, which was clearly intended to slander the Prophet, went unnoticed when it was shown at a small theater in L.A. But somebody pushed a computer button, sending it worldwide on YouTube. Violence followed in many countries, and a number of people died. All of this after no study, no vetting, and no review. Back in 1989, Salman Rushdie tried his best to raise consciousness about the human event of revelation and its connection to words considered by so many humans to be holy, and to have somehow come from beyond the human realm. The video maker and the right-wing Christian groups that backed him engaged in a deliberate act of slander. Anyone who speaks of these two publishing events in the same breath should take another deep one and hold it and let it out slowly. One was a serious artistic and literary effort probing serious questions published with no expectation that violence would follow. It took me 15 minutes just now to explain just what questions it was the author was trying to ask. The other is a one-dimensional, sophomoric piece of junk, self-distributed without serious review, but with full awareness that pushing a send button would be like pulling a trigger and that someone somewhere would almost certainly die, like they always do these days. Everybody knows it. Free speech goes beyond being a simple right for most of us, more than something that we merely value. For us, it's something sacred. And I mean by that the freedom itself, beyond whatever we may express when exercising it. I trust that most of us value freedom of speech and artistic expression and will fight hard in order to preserve them from whoever tries to take them from us. But I'm also certain that most of us are aware that these freedoms have different limits in different nations and communities. There's a difference between exercising these freedoms, one, as a citizen of the United States, and two, as a citizen of the world. We are citizens of both now, far more than we were in 1989. I think everybody knows that, too. When we speak freely in the new ways that have become available, ways that can transmit messages from the palm of my hand to millions or billions of others around the world in less than a minute, it's vitally important that we teach ourselves to speak responsibly, as if the lives of people who we've never met depend on it. Why? Because they do. 1 year after his book came out and his world turned upside down, Salman Rushdie wrote, "I feel as if I've been plunged like Alice into the world beyond the looking glass, where nonsense is the only available sense. And I wonder if I'll ever be able to climb back through the mirror. I regret that so many people who might have taken pleasure in finding their reality, given pride of place in a novel, will now not read it because of what they believe it to be, or will come to it with their minds already made up. Please understand, however, I make no complaint. I'm a writer. I do not accept my condition. I will strive to change it. But I inhabit it, trying to learn from it. Our lives teach us who we are. Our lives teach us who we are. Letter by letter, line by line, with patience and with love, may our lives always do just that. Right here, right now, and in all the days to come. So may it be.